Feeling low. It's that time of the year.
It's that time of the year for feeling low.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, we were talking about that. It's that weird season where everybody comes back to campus and brings all their foreign germs with them. Not foreign as in, like, other, like, just from where people are. Anyway, I'm not going to stick
mystery germs.
Yeah, mystery germs.
So
there we go.
Forgive me if I don't share too much today, but...
Well, there you go. I have lots to share.
Oh, right on. Right.
Open Source is a CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show. You can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of the screen. And you can listen to us anytime by accessing Open Sources on the CFRU archive page. Today, we will be talking to Andrew Seagram, the Guelph candidate for the New Democratic Party. But first, a rundown of what we've got going on in terms of our election coverage. We will be carrying out these interviews with the candidates through till Election Day, which is October 19th. So we still have two more after today. Next Thursday and the Thursday after that. The complete schedule is on our Open Sources website, opensourcesguelph.com. And as always, if you'd like to submit a question for any of the candidates, feel free to reach out through the website, our Facebook page, Open Sources Newswire, or on Twitter at OS underscore Guelph. And we will also be able to offer you downloaded versions of this show now. You can go to Podbean and search Guelph Politicast, and on the Guelph Politicast feed is also all the episodes of Open Sources since July 16th. Most importantly, all our candidate interviews so far. So that's where you'll be able to find our interviews with Cornelius Clevering, Alex Feckery, Tristan Dineen, and Lloyd Longfield. And it will be where you'll be able to find all the candidate interviews once we've done them chronologically, because we are not time travelers.
Yet.
Anyway, if you want to listen to the show again, just go to the show notes page on Open Sources, and you can hear the just-aired episode. And finally, on election night, we will be broadcasting live to air from the Bullring. We will be joined by the CFRU news team, bringing you all the results from coast to coast to coast right here on the U of G campus. And maybe have a pint.
And a contest, too, actually.
Yes, so there is a contest.
Should mention that.
Yes. And we will be asking people to submit their guesses for how many seats each party will get and how many seats the winning party will get and what that winning party will be. And we will have assorted prizes to be named later.
Closest to the pin wins, but if you get them exactly, we'll double
closest
the price.
Closest without going over.
We'll double it.
Price is Right rules. The closest without going over. Anyway, we will get to today's interviewee. The lucky candidate who joins us here today is Andrew Seagram of the New Democratic Party of Canada. Andrew, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And it's a pleasure having you. I just want to mention off the top, in the interest of full disclosure, I do have a previous relationship with Andrew because we were both on the Ed Video Media Arts Center Board of Directors at the same time. He was president and treasurer at the time, and I was a lowly director. And of course, Andrew is the founder of the Guelph Comedy Festival, which Ed Video does help sponsor every year. So I just want that out in the open.
Can I just plug Guelph Comedy Festival this weekend, October 3rd? It's coming up.
Excellent. Yeah, I did plug it on our website as well. That was, since you were coming in, I put a link. So
thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Are you still involved in a daily way because you're campaigning? Or
no, I'm helping out a little bit peripherally, and I'm aware that it's happening, but I've had to pull back.
You're the founder and emeritus.
Yeah. And hopefully we can get involved again in other ways. But right now, the guys down at Making Box are putting it together and doing a fantastic job. Jay and Rick, shout out to them. They're doing a fantastic job with the festival.
Great. And so I just wanted to make that note. So if you think I'm throwing softballs on Andrew, you know why.
Thank you.
Anyway, let's start by having you tell a bit about yourself to the people out there. Who is Andrew Seagram?
Who am I? Well, I'm a community activist. I've been the co-chair of the Guelph and Wellington Poverty Task Force for 2 years. I, as you mentioned, founded the Guelph Comedy Festival. I'm in a wonderful relationship of 7 years with Karen, my partner. I have two kids who are 17 and 22, both amazing people. I've been in Guelph for 22 years. not consecutively. I was here for the university, and then I went out west for 8 years, and then came back, and so I've been here since 1998. 97.
So you were parachuted in, is what you're saying?
Yeah, parachuted in many, many years ago, just in preparation for this campaign run. Yeah, another NDP or another parachute candidate. I grew up in Toronto, though, and with three brothers, and it was a good time. I like Toronto.
Of the four major party candidates, you are probably the least politically experienced. I mean, there's a former city councilor, there's the former environmental commissioner, Lloyd Longfield, even though Chamber of Commerce president isn't a political position, you can't say it isn't political in some regards.
Sure.
So how have you been finding campaigning? Has there been a learning curve for you going from activist to politician?
There has been. And I mean, I have been in politics for a long time. I've run election campaigns. I ran Phil Ault's campaign 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I've been working with the NDP for a long time, and I worked with them in the background when I was living in British Columbia as well. But as a candidate, it's a different kind of experience. I've just been gaining sort of the energy, and I'm just surprised at I thought it was going to be a little easier, but it's hard work, and it can be a stressful and stressful in a repetitive kind of way. It's mm-hmm. it's like carpal tunnel. You just got to get it over repetitive action. You just got to keep going. But I'm finding it wonderful meeting people, getting a lot of great feedback from folks, and the NDP message is getting out.
Well, for example, of repetition, two big debates in 1 week.
Yeah. And we actually had a third last night.
Yeah, that's right.
Home Builders Association. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, no, it's a lot of prep, and that's a lot of prep and a lot of preparation. And you're torn between getting out and actually, shaking the hands and doing the canvassing and prepping and being accessible to the people and the media and making sure you've got that presence. I like both equally, so I'm fortunate that way.
Let's talk about, you mentioned you were active with the NDP for a long time. What was it about the NDP that struck your political fancy in terms of your own personal politics?
The NDP has always represented what I believe, and it's the Social Justice Party. It's the party of equity and ensuring a level playing field for everyone. It's the party that brought in the programs that Canadians love. I mean, we brought in healthcare, and we wouldn't be anywhere without it. I listened to my parents talk about life before health insurance, and mm-hmm. It's a treacherous, precarious place, and it's a place we can never go back to.
Yeah.
So the NDP has always inspired me. Out in BC, we won once in a while, so it was pretty awesome. In Ontario, it's a bit more of a slug at times, but it's always worth getting the message out.
A lot of people are looking at the NDP, the federal NDP this time, and are perhaps wondering if because the NDP won official opposition status last time, and which was kind of one step closer to achieving a federal government, if perhaps the party is moving more to the center this time with certain policies, are you detecting that as a longtime NDP member?
I don't detect us moving to the center. I detect that people are telling us we're moving to the center.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I think we're holding on to our core values and experiences. I think what we've gotten is we've gotten better at being a bit of a political machine, which you have to be in order to win an election. But no, I mean, I know people have said, we're going to have balanced budgets. But NDP governments uniformly, I know there's some with yell nay, but uniformly have balanced budgets. As we've always said, Tommy Douglas had 17. Roy Romano had balanced budgets. Dewar had balanced budgets. It's something that we do. And so to say that that's not left because we want to tax and spend is ironic, right? We understand mm-hmm. money, and we understand how we have to work and live within our means.
Is it also possible that the country is moving left? I'm thinking of particularly the issue of marijuana legalization, because there is polls out that show that this is an issue a lot of people have changed on in terms of wanting either decriminalization or outright legalization of marijuana.
Yeah. I think what we know now is what a disaster our drug policy is. And any further to the right with it, we're going to end up with an American-style court and penal system for marijuana. People have been put in jail for smoking pot, and they should not have been. And our jails, and we're ruining people's lives just because they've smoked a joint. And it's and I think that sensibility and that acknowledgement of what that means is dawning on people. I don't know if it's a switch to the left per se. I just think it's a right-headed position on a sensible position. To not ruin people's lives for doing something. I mean, Canadians, I just read, are the number one pot smokers in the world. Like, what are we going to do? We're going to put everybody away in jail? Like, it's a sensible position. The NDP position is decriminalization, you know, not legalization. So we're taking it out of the hands of dealers, and well, not necessarily, but what we are doing is we're allowing people to have possession of marijuana and not being arrested for it. They may be fined, but they don't have to worry about going to jail.
What's the substantive difference, do you think, or in terms of the effect on society between decriminalization and legalization?
And legalization?
Yeah.
I think it's just, well, the NDP has had a long-standing position of decriminalization. So, you know, maybe we haven't quite caught up to full legalization yet. And I think it's pretty amazing what's happening in the United States with legalization there. And the difference between that and legalization is then it's then sold and marketed, right? It's then fully integrated into stores and shops like alcohol. Yeah, I don't know if Canadians are quite ready for that experience yet. I don't know. But I think Canadians don't want to be sending people to jail for smoking pot.
Fair enough. Let's move to tying into the overall party. Your party leader, Tom Mulcair. I asked Lloyd Longfield last week, what could he tell us about his leader, Justin Trudeau, that perhaps in his experience that the public may not know about? And I realize, of course, that with 330 ridings, you know, Tom Mulcair can't, you know, spend the afternoon with every one of his candidates. But yeah. In terms of your interactions, what can you tell us that we don't know about Tom Mulcair?
Tom has a wicked sense of humor. He's incredibly funny and quick-witted. And he's a deeply understanding guy. I think part of the media has been painting him as this mean person, you know. It's like, no, I mean, he gets into Parliament and he does his job, and he does his job well. But when you get outside, you shake his hand, you have a conversation with him, and it's full of humor and warmth and decency. And I think that's something people aren't aware of. That he's and quick. I mean, I think people know he's smart, but he's really sharp. He's a very smart man. He's a person we'd want as prime minister.
I never say he was mean, but there are times he does seem there is an angry Tom, isn't there?
Yeah, well, I think that's how it's been characterized. Other people would say, you know, he's just doing his duty and getting frustrated with in opposition and trying to talk with Stephen Harper, who will not respond, and the rights of Canadian people to be able to know what the government's doing and have answers. And so it's frustrating, and I think that anger is felt throughout. I know when I'm knocking on doors, the first thing people say 19 out of 20 times is get rid of Harper. And it's, you know, it's as nice as that to as unbelievably nasty as you can imagine about what to do with Stephen Harper. And so, I think what you're just seeing is the frustration of government and the process of government.
Well, all that I get. And I wanted to reference back to something you've been saying at some of the debates. A lot of people have been asking about whipped votes and voting with the party, and that's come up in more than one debate that I've been at. And in terms of your response, you've said, well, I agree with like 9 out of 10 times with the party, and then the 10% of the time I hold my nose and for the good of the party. What kind of subjects are in those 10% of the times?
10%? I don't even know yet. I haven't been in caucus and haven't had a chance to vote.
But surely there have been times, you know, you see, like, watch on CPAC and or just interviews with the, even Tom Mulcair or other high-profile members of the party where you hear them say something. It's like, oh, I don't know if I agree with that.
Well, they may say something, but for the most part, they've voted in line with what I would believe.
Mm-hmm.
What would it be? You know, I've racked my brain a little bit trying to think about specific legislation, and I said this publicly the other night. You know, I wouldn't vote for a war of choice,
right,
but I can't imagine that the New Democrats would ever supporting a war, you know, and continuing, let's say, in Iraq, which I call a war of choice. People call a war of choice because we didn't have to get involved. We shouldn't have got involved, and yet Harper chose to get involved. So I think those are along the lines. You know, the only way I could imagine voting for a war is if Canadian soil is actually in trouble.
So is there a circumstance you think where you would vote for an interventionist military action? Like, aside from what you just mentioned, you know, where Canada's in danger, but in terms of, you know, if there's really terrible humanitarian crisis or something.
You know, we talk about this, and if it was UN mandated, mm-hmm. and if we went through the UN and it was done hopefully in a peacekeeping mode, and it was a fully legal, responsible war that had clear in and out exit strategy, and we understood why we're doing it,
mm-hmm.
and that if the Canadian, you know, and it was an act. But the problem is with that, and we get into it, is that there's so many humanitarian crises around the world that are completely and totally ignored. Mm. And they're completely and totally ignored because of strategic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you look at Nigeria, you look at Africa, you look at Sub-Saharan Africa, you look at the Congo. I mean, what's going on there pales in comparison to many other places of the world, but we're doing nothing. Why are we doing nothing? You know, mm-hmm. it's a geopolitical thing. So, you know, I think we have to really have an understanding and temper what we're doing, have full UN backing, and then I might consider it. But I'm not an overall pacifist, but I do believe in defense. I believe mm-hmm. we have to defend ourselves and we defend our territory. But we have to be very careful. I mean, if you look at the first Iraq war,
mm.
we had a full UN mandate to go in. We had the Russians. I'll never forget the Syrians coming off the planes and fighting with, you know, American troops back in 1990.
Right.
But even then, there was an understanding, there seemed to be, it was clear, it was the beginning of what has now become 25 years of military action in Iraq. So we have to think what we're doing through, and we have to think why it's happening.
Well, that's a good way to get into the refugee crisis. The debate today, you were talking about how you've been talking to members of the public here in Guelph, businesses that want to sponsor Syrian refugees, but can't.
That was actually Lloyd.
I apologize.
Yep, no problem.
But I'm sure maybe you've been hearing some of the same things about concerned about the Syrian refugee crisis.
Absolutely.
So, what's the first initial step do you think an NDP government would do in terms of addressing Syrian refugees?
Well, we'll bring in 10,000 refugees by the end of 2015, and we'll bring 46,000 refugees in over the period of next 4 years, and we'll open up sponsored refugees and unlimited unsponsored or fully sponsored refugees.
Mm-hmm.
I know the concerns over safety and terrorists. And, you know, I worked for Immigration Canada for 6 years. I was on the ground when we had the Kosovo airlift and I was leading through. I would greet people literally getting off the plane in the airport and guide them through the whole immigration process. And these folks were 90% Muslim. We put them through the process, and everything was fine. These individuals that I worked with specifically had family in Canada, so right. They would get sent throughout all of Canada. And, you know, I was personally there when the screening happened, the immigration process, and there's never been a boo of concern about our Kosovar Muslim Albanian refugees. And I suspect the same. And the Syrian refugee crisis is so much worse. And I don't mean to ever, you know, try to balance out what's worse or worse, but there's right. 4 million refugees coming out of Syria, people living in horrendous conditions. And the world has to attest for it. And look what's happening in Europe, the flood into Europe mm-hmm. of people. And there's just no end in sight. The world has to pick this up, and we have to pull back. We have to create peace, and we have to have conversations and allow people to live lives, or it's just going to spread and get worse and worse and worse.
The numbers you mentioned, is that government sponsorship or is that just altogether?
No, it's the 10,000.
Right.
Yeah, no, that's government sponsored.
Okay.
And then they open up a full cap on publicly sponsored refugees.
Okay.
Yeah.
Since we opened the door kind of to talk about the safety issue, Bill C-51, and it's another thing that keeps coming up in
sure.
debates, even though no one on the stage here voted in favor for it. But, I mean, still, it's something a lot of people are genuinely concerned about. Is that becoming a bit of a wedge issue, do you think?
I think it's more than a wedge issue. I think it's a clear defining issue between the Liberals and the Conservatives and the NDP.
Mm-hmm.
It's a C-51. I mean, the Liberals voted for it. They whipped the vote. And even though some folks might not have liked it, they supported it. And they've even now, you know, they're now saying they will keep it and get rid of specific pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
But has there really been a conversation about, you know, what they think those specific pieces are?
Mm-hmm.
It's a huge part. It's part of a, I don't know, I think a 1,000-page omnibus bill. It impacts 17 pieces of legislation, and the whole thing has to get pulled back. The whole thing, because they're it's like a tendril. It's like a spider web, and we've got to just get rid of the whole thing. And if we need more legislation, which I don't think we do, then we go at it. But what this bill does is it allows for CSIS to be able to police its own intelligence. And what usually happens is they get intelligence, they pass it over, say, to the RCMP. There's oversight on the RCMP. But now CSIS is going to be able to police and follow up legally on its own intelligence and only has to go get a warrant if they believe they're breaking the Constitution, which isn't, you know, intelligence agencies aren't known for admitting that maybe they're going extra constitutional.
Right.
So the plan is to is to pull it back. We have enough legislation in place to be able to more than adequately keep Canadians safe. And that's recognized across the board from law enforcement agencies and intelligence services.
Mm-hmm. I only ask because I sometimes feel that Justin Trudeau, if he hadn't supported, like I have this feeling there was probably about 4 different attack ads queued up on the YouTube page of Conservative headquarters waiting for him to vote no on it. And I find it curious on that if that would.
Oh, that's what he said.
Right.
I mean, he said he was going to vote for it because he didn't want to get attacked by Harper
right.
in the election. And I don't know what kind of moral compass is that. That's all I can say. And that's my cheapest shot that I'm going to make. But honestly, what does that say about the man?
Right.
That he's not willing to stand up for Canadians to Stephen Harper on a piece of legislation that make sure that everybody's cell phone and email is read and heard, you know?
Mm-hmm.
A wedge issue or I think it just shows a moral difference in the way in which we do politics.
Fair enough. But in the business of Stop Harper, which you are hearing on so many doors, and there has been another question that's been plaguing the leaders in terms of coalition and working together. Is there a deal breaker, do you think, in terms of whether or not the the Liberals and the NDP forming a coalition, or even just an agreement to go forward working together? Like, is there something so that neither party would support that would stop that?
Like a specific piece of legislation,
or
say?
Or even something in general?
Well, I think Justin Trudeau is what will stop a coalition from mm-hmm. happening between the two parties, if that came to be, if that came to pass. We see maybe the TPP. I don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. there's some trade agreements that are going out there. Mm-hmm. There would have to be some very serious negotiation as to how to make it work. Mm-hmm. But no, we understand. I think both the Liberals and the NDP are decidedly clear in not supporting Harper should he get a minority government.
Right.
And that I wouldn't be surprised, and this is just pure conjecture, and I'm sounding more like a pundit than a politician, but that at some point, you know, a coalition government in the case of minority is something that will be very seriously pursued. Mm-hmm. I mean, Trudeau came out and said he'd never get in a coalition with the NDP with Mulcair's leader. Mm. I don't know what the qualifier was for or about, but I don't know. Time will tell. Liberals can be very adaptable.
Well put. It will be interesting to see if that happens. Do you think maybe he's scared of Tom? Does he have angry Tom phobia?
Once he gets to know Tom, it'll be okay. They'll have a good hug and everything will be fine.
Good enough.
Yeah.
We're going to stop here for a musical break and for some PSAs, and then we will come right back and have Andrew Seagram answer some more pressing questions from myself and Scotty if he feels up to it at some point. Well, he's shaking his head. No, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. Anyway,
trying not to cough.
Fair enough.
Just one question, Scott.
We'll be right back here on Open Sources. You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
What's up? This is Teaspoon from Delhi to Dublin, and you're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
And that was Doug and the Slugs from their album Music for the Heart of Thinking, 1982. It's from our vinyl archives, and there's a little bit of a story behind that, too.
Well, it's because our guest threw a shout-out for Doug and the Slugs at the debates downstairs today. You were a student here, and there was a concert at Peter Clark Hall with Doug and the Slugs.
Doug and the Slugs, yeah. I went 2 years in a row, and they came through, and one of my favorite Canadian bands of all time. Really could rock it out and, theatrical on the stage. And, we were just saying, Doug passed away in 2004, but his music lives on. So does his heart.
And it lives on in vinyl here at CFRU.
Right on CFRU.
One of the number of vinyl selections we have here at the station. And, we love to whip out the vinyl sometimes.
So call our request line.
Call them.
Scott talks.
It's
barely.
Unfortunately, this isn't the all-request open house party hour. This is Open Sources, and Andrew Seagram is our the NDP candidate for Guelph is our guest this hour. And actually, playing the music is a nice segue to a question I wanted to ask you, since you are active in the cultural community here.
Sure.
And we don't hear a lot about arts and culture in campaigns usually, and it feels like we're hearing about it even less this campaign.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. I had somebody come and ask me that question earlier. It hasn't hit, I guess. And it's not that it doesn't deserve to be spoken about, because it does. Arts and culture is the backbone of society, really. I mean, it defines who we are and how we express ourselves. Mm-hmm. I guess the issue, there's the issue in the campaign has been so much about, at least from my perspective, has been about getting Stephen Harper out and about climate change and these profound issues that, unfortunately, I would say that arts and culture isn't getting what it should. Mm-hmm. You know, I would like to see us get back to the Council of Canadians, not the Council of Canadians, the Canada Council mm-hmm. of the Arts, and make sure that we refund them and pull back all of the cuts that Stephen Harper has put in. It should be a more of an issue. But, you know, I think it's the scale of this election, and yeah. it's just what's been happening that it hasn't popped up.
Yeah, it seems like it's 26 out of 25 in terms of issues,
yeah.
unfortunately.
And it's true, and it's sad, and it shouldn't be, and I'm happy to speak for it and once elected, scream for it in caucus and in government and to reinstate funding. As I say, the arts community struggles enough as it is, day by day, mm-hmm. and that's a Doug and the Slugs reference too, by the way. So, now I'm singing the song in my head.
Well, let me ask you this because it kind of goes along with culture. And there's been a lot of examples of candidates sort of being attacked for previous social media statements. And unfortunately, present company isn't excluded. And there's a new Twitter handle somebody pointed out to me today, Guelph Tory, and he seems to be picking on you a lot. Why are these people picking on you, Andrew?
Why are they picking on me? They don't know me. They wouldn't pick on me if they knew me. I've stopped reading the Twitter stuff a while back, really, and mm-hmm. The comments and that sort of thing. Social media has really come to dominate a part of this election, and really it'd be better if we were talking about arts and culture than social media. Mm. I think in the long run, what we're really looking at is the fact that we're at this transition point of understanding what social media is and its impacts, and in 15 years, 20 years, when university students today are going out and want to get elected, we're just going to have to go, oh, okay, you know, and be very, very forgiving about what people have said on social media.
I'm curious about that myself because I'm a frequent social media user, and every time this comes out, I mean, I don't think twice about a lot of these things, and I know people are like, yes, I'm getting dirt on so-and-so and this person, and it just seems like there's going to have to come a point where we're just going to have to be cool with it, because it's almost the same thing as if someone were to follow you around all their life with a recorder just in case you said something untoward.
Just in case you do say it. Exactly. I guess Facebook isn't as private a medium as people believe it to be, but mm-hmm. it's also not something that should be really thrown against, especially its context. I think what this will lead to, and I'm hoping it leads to, is more of this, more of actual conversation and discussion, mm-hmm. because you can take anything out of context, you can twist anything, and, and either destroy people's lives or disrupt their lives or make it more difficult and have to answer for something, you know, that is contextually wrong. Mm-hmm. Takes a lot of energy when you want to talk about what the issues are and what's happening in Guelph.
As you're the founder of the Guelph Comedy Festival, so I assume you have a sense of humor.
I'm working on it.
Has that helped you out a lot campaigning, especially when you get into situations like this?
Yes. You know, it did. Some days, you know, I can laugh, but I also realize that, you know, maybe sarcasm doesn't play well on social media. But you know what? To be honest, there were dark moments there. It was like, wow, really? This is what it's come down to? You know, myself and other candidates put themselves out there and put themselves into the public arena to do the best they can and to serve a good and a common good. And it comes down to trite and misinformed and really, really out of context quotes. And so, you know, and it's happening across the country.
Right.
And it's happening to so many people. And as I say, I hope it leads to larger conversation, that we realize we can't understand the world in 140 characters, and that we really do have to begin listening and talking.
I want to talk about some more issues, and one of the things somebody actually asked me about to ask you when you appeared on the show, you mentioned at the debate the other night, the Guelph Chamber debate, you are in favor of making unpaid internships illegal, which I believe is something also the Green Party has put forth.
Mm-hmm.
This person wanted to ask about temp agencies, though, and he's in what he's called a temp trap.
Sure.
And what that means is he kind of goes from temp job to temp job to temp job, which it almost seems like it's in this negative zone between full-time employment and unpaid internships. Is there a way to address that?
It's a quasi-land. It's awful. People aren't getting their benefits, and people aren't be able to stabilize their lives. I'm sure there could be something legislated about it. It's mm-hmm. be a provincial issue, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I understand, and you're just asking me off the top of the hand, and I'm not exactly sure what we could do legislatively as far as making it safer and better and making sure that people have benefits. Temp agencies are making a lot of money off of the backs of people and their labor. And so I think if people get caught in the trap, it's unfortunate. I think it's potentially has a way for people to make it into a job, hopefully.
Right.
And I mean, that's all the temp agencies ever. It's temporary. And the idea has been to offer people temporary work. But people getting trapped into the cycle, that's no way to live. So hopefully we can offer programs to help lift people up and out of that cycle.
Right. It's the same as the internships. Internships used to lead to a job.
And that was the point of an internship. Yeah. And now it's just, it's servitude. It's unbelievable. And the NDP would bring in legislation, health and safety legislation, labor legislation, and make sure anti-sexual harassment legislation to make sure that people are safe and are being paid to do work. And nobody should leave school with $50,000 in debt in their pocket and then have to go work for free. Like, how do people survive? You know, wealthy people, I imagine, can.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody who would like to get a leg up in an industry who's got debt and has to pay off has to go and find another job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it be Starbucks or anything.
Right.
You know, I probably shouldn't say any name brands. A coffee shop or anything. Just to survive.
In terms of revisiting, when we're talking about arts and culture, there are so many different priorities. And I think there's a really big question in terms of where do we start? And say, you are part of an NDP government. What is the first thing? Or what, in terms of even just your point of view, what's the first priority? Where do we start in addressing these problems?
The first thing. Well, there's a number of first things, and I know that's my qualifier, but you've got a minister for every portfolio, and they'd all have a first thing to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to take action on climate change. We have to become a world leader again, and we have to be there in December as a country that wants to put climate change on the map and that we're going to lead in our emission controls and that we're going to become, a leader in the environment again. We have to undo so much of the legislation that Stephen Harper has put forward, period. We have to go back. We have to protect our lakes. We have to begin and create a cultural shift where Stephen Harper doesn't believe in science and history and sociology, where, just because you don't believe in it doesn't mean it's not real, right? And so we have to go and we have to bring in and create trust in government again, with our scientists, with our top bureaucrats, with the whole bureaucracy, that they're not living in fear of saying anything. And we've got to let people know it's safe, and we have to create a government that's going to go out there and meet the needs of the Canadian people and not just what a single man's vision of Canada is.
Well, he believes in the history of hockey. He wrote a book about it.
Well, I know. I mean, I keep thinking that. I've honestly thought that. I thought, well, he believes in that history. Why doesn't he believe in other history or sociology? And I mean, when he said that the missing and murdered women you know, is not a sociological issue is it's mind-boggling. Mm-hmm. We will, within the first 100 days, we will put in an inquiry into missing and murdered women in Canada, Aboriginal women in Canada. And, you know, I've got a couple of stories that when I lived, worked out in British Columbia, I worked at a youth shelter with kids, and young women who had been working in the streets would come and work or come and stay at the youth shelter when we were in Victoria, and they would tell stories about their friends who were going missing in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Like, we would hear these stories.
And this was the early 90s?
Oh, yeah, this was the early 90s. This was 1990.
Wow.
You know, so we know that this has been going on forever and ever and ever, and yet we've done nothing. And just when the whole Robert Picton thing exploded, people knew what was going on. It was just ignored. And these people, these human beings, were being ignored because mostly because they were native or they were prostitutes or deemed lesser. Mm-hmm. And we allowed, you know, we've allowed criminals and murderers to go on. So, no, it's something we've got to put a stop to.
Since you mentioned portfolios, I was wondering if you have any cabinet ambitions.
I have MP ambitions.
There's nothing you want to, because it was the question at the thing today, if you were environment minister.
Yeah.
So you don't have your eye on anything in particular?
You know, I think I need to do a steep learning curve on being an MP. They've got a whole selection of MPs that will be coming in. Who will make great cabinet ministers. So right now, it would be my focus on serving Guelph and establishing myself within the caucus. And who knows, maybe one day. But I can't imagine I'm going to walk in and say, Tom Mulcair is going to go, "Who are you? Oh, yeah, you, buddy. Yeah, come here. Take over the Ministry of Environment." Yeah? It's like, that's just not going to happen. So no, I'm not fooling myself in that way.
I wanted to bring this up before we went out of time. You mentioned transit the other night as a priority, and that makes me happy as a transit user. There's, in terms of what amount of influence that someone on the federal level, because it is a more municipal and provincial thing, what can the federal government do for transit?
Well, we can direct fund transit, I mean, through the province, but to municipalities. Mm-hmm. And that we can, well, like the federal government's directing billions towards the Toronto subway, right? And each level of government can direct funds to it. We've got Transport Canada, so it's not totally outside of our jurisdiction. But yeah, no, we can direct funds, and we can work with municipalities and the province and negotiate the way in which transit needs to be helped. I think everybody recognizes that if there's dollars for transit, then we're going to find ways of spending it. And right. So yeah, it's a negotiation, it's a discussion, but it needs to happen, especially around here, getting people moving and safely just within Guelph and then interregionally. We need smarter, faster transit so people can feel confident and on time and constant, so people can feel confident about leaving their cars and taking the subway, or not the subway. I grew up in Toronto. I grew up on the subway, but just taking public transit.
Well, we did used to have streetcars here, too.
I know. I love those pictures. But, of course, you know, that's the danger of light rail. You can just rip it up. And that subway is, you know.
Sure enough. I always ask this of every candidate that comes in. Is there a particular issue that you don't think is getting enough airtime during this campaign? Maybe it's something you are wanting to talk about, something people on the doorsteps are telling you about?
Well, for me, I mean, I've worked in food security, and I've worked on the Poverty Task Force, and my job at the Upper Grand District School Board is about community use of schools, and it's part of the poverty reduction strategy. So I guess for me, it's income inequality and poverty, really addressing that reality. We've got a growing income gap. We've got more and more people falling behind. Wages are dropping, so people you know, aren't making as much money, and they're working poor. And we need to figure out how to make sure that people can A, make enough money, and B, offer a social safety net that securely allows people to live a decent life, and whether they be, you know, and seniors as well. I mean, they're all falling into poverty as pensions fail or wane and change. So, yeah. No, I think income inequality, which is a bigger political issue because you're talking about politics and you're talking about class when you're talking about income inequality.
Right.
You know, but if you look at what's happened, particularly since 2008, incomes for the bottom, 60% have stagnated and if not gone down, whereas from 2008 on, income for the top wealthiest people has just gone through the roof. Mm. You know, I mean, it's astronomical. And in the States, it's even more astounding. And that's if you don't deal with income inequality, you get social unrest. The fact is, people who live in poverty die younger, but they also access health services much, much more. You could save billions of dollars by just ensuring people aren't living in poverty. Mm-hmm. Health services alone, because they walk through the emergency room, they don't have GPs, and they use up hospital services. And people who are living in poverty need to find ways to feed themselves. And often that's petty crime. And so crime rates go down dramatically. And people feel so much safer when they've got an income and they know that they're going to be able to feed their kids. So it's a big, big issue for me. And I'd love to be able to talk about it more.
And you actually said something interesting today. I don't mean that as like you said something, but at the debate you said everyone sees themselves as middle class, and this was in reference to helping the middle class. And I do find this term interesting because it seems to be a talking point for everybody.
Yeah.
But we had Lloyd Longfield in last week, and he said, "Well, the liberals see middle class as $45,000 and $90,000." And my thought was, "Well, to a lot of people out there, $90,000 is a fortune. It's not middle class; it's a fortune."
Yeah, that'd be at the very least upper middle class. $90,000 is a real wage that people can count on and help send their kids through university with.
Mm-hmm.
No, middle class, and I said earlier that people do, because people don't like to see themselves as living in poverty. Mm-hmm. And so most people define themselves as middle class. So with the NDP, we've gone with that. We've accepted that that's the way people see. But we also recognize that within their own definition, that, they don't have that income security. They don't have that food security. They don't have that housing security for some people that even call themselves middle class. And so we're reaching out and we're going to, support affordable housing. But it's a self-defined thing. It's
right.
It's not, there are some people that will call themselves low income or poor or living in poverty. And the NDP is, that's a given for us, that we're working to help those people.
Right. I do wonder if that may have something to do with the fact that we don't hear a lot about poverty in these elections. And then no matter what the level of for what level of government is, we don't hear a lot about poverty or helping people or even, as you said, income inequality, which has sort of become a buzzword in a lot of campaigns.
We don't. We don't. And it's too much of a challenge, and it really, really questions the way in which we view politics and we view our economy and we have a philosophic view of what poverty is. And we believe that everybody can just rise up and pull themselves up and make a living. But, the irony is that we have an economic system that demands a fluid labor force. And when they say fluid, that means unemployed people.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the economy doesn't allow for support while people are unemployed, right? So we can't have it both ways. If we want to allow for fluid labor, then we should be supporting people when they're unemployed. People want to be working much more than they want to be on EI, I assure you,
mm-hmm.
or on income assistance or any kind of financial support. People like to participate.
Well, that kind of leaves it on a downer note.
Sorry. Happy Day. Guelph Comedy Festival.
There you go. If people want to learn more about your campaign or get in touch with you, how can they do that?
Andrew.Seagram@ndp.ca. That's our email.
Great. And I just want to thank you again, Andrew, for coming in today. It was great talking to you, and good luck with the rest of the campaign.
Thank you very much. It was great talking with you and hearing you, Scott, sort of.
I hope, yes. We hope Scotty hasn't infected you.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Somehow my questions got answered, though, so that, oh, that's all, good. It all worked out.
Yeah, that's good.
That's how we roll here at Open Sources.
It's telepathic.
And, yeah, that's right. And we roll on our website as well, opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, and at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. You can get in touch with me at Adam A. Donaldson. That's my Twitter handle, my personal Twitter handle. And, of course, you can go to my blog, guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
And I'm Scotty Hertz on Twitter and on Facebook as well, and scottyhertz@bell.net.
And you can also
send a postcard to the station. Answer it, maybe.
And you can also find Scotty in room 407 at Guelph General Hospital later tonight.
Yeah, no, I'll be fine, honest.
And we will be back here next week. Well, at least I will be here next week with another candidate interview. Stay tuned for that and getting more information about the upcoming election. We're almost done, folks. There's another couple of weeks. In the meantime, we will have another show for you here on CFRU at the top of the hour. Open Sources Guelph will be back next week, Thursdays at 5 p.m. 93.3 FM. CFRU.ca is where you can listen to us, of course, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. As for right now, we will leave you with a bit of Al Jazeera news, and we'll see you next time.